from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Well, El Gringo Pussycato. Yes, folks, Speedy Gonzales makes a quick visit to 30 Laps this week from 1955 with his cousin Slowpoke Rodriguez and voiced by the wonderful Mel Blanc. Speedy has been racing around for 65 years, so it's sombreros off to him this week. Well, perhaps not to him so much, but the original Speedy Gonzales. We start a series every now and then, probably every other week, from the British Motorsport magazine, and we start with Froilan Gonzales, the very fast Argentinian. So let's hit the Tabasco Road this week at 30 laps. Mr. Gonzales, here's our motormouth. And how about this for a subject? Let's look how to pronounce those unusual car names. Now there's a challenge, especially for yours truly. I graduated with honours at the Mispronunciation Mispronunciation University. Plenty of bad examples in the past. But let's take the bull by the horns, eh? Crikey, Mexican speedsters, Argentinian drivers, Spanish bulls. This is certainly not Ferdinand, like the show we did last year. Olay! And away we go at 30 laps. But first, from Wikipedia. Speedy Gonzales is an animated cartoon character in the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies series of cartoons. He is portrayed as the fastest mouse in all of Mexico, with his major traits being the ability to run extremely fast, speaking with an exaggerated Mexican accent, and also speaking Spanish. He usually wears a yellow sombrero, white shirt and trousers, which was a common traditional outfit worn by men and boys of rural Mexican villages, and a red kerchief, similar to that of traditional Mexican attire. To date, there have been 46 cartoons made either starring or featuring Speedy Gonzales. Ha! No stereotypes there at all, hey? But on to the real Speedy Gonzales. From Motorsport magazine, written July 7, 2014, by Nigel Roebuck, José Froilán Gonzales on his way to winning Ferrari's first World Championship Grand Prix at Silverstone. So let's see what Nigel's got to say. When Michael Schumacher won the Belgian Grand Prix last year, it was just another Sunday in a Ferrari summer. But Michael's 10th victory of the 2002, I beg your pardon, 10th victory of 2002, was also the 100th win for Ferrari using Shell. And a happy coincidence of that was the presence at Monza of the man who scored the very first victory. José Froilán Gonzales's victory in the 1951 British Grand Prix was not only the first on Shell, but the first for Ferrari since the inception of the World Championship. Now, a month before his 80th birthday, he's back in the paddock again and looking extremely well on it. In his racing days, Gonzales was indeed a burly fellow, but Stirling Moss can attest that there was nothing wiry with his fitness. It was solid muscle, boy, believe me. Now, in old age, he seems about half his size. He bursts with good humour as he remembers his racing days, speaking quickly, laughing often. And he makes his elevation to the top level of motor racing sound deceptively straightforward. Fangio went to Europe in 1949. The following year, I came over, driving for the Automobile Club of Argentina, racing as Scuderi Aquila Vasi. He drove Maserati 4CLTs in the dark blue and yellow colours of Argentina, but they weren't very competitive or reliable. His luck was a little better in Formula 2 races, driving a Ferrari 166 for the same team. But at the end of the year, back in South America, the cars were supercharged for use in Formula 1 Libre Temporada, and he finished twice second to his teammate Fangio. At the beginning of 1951, a couple of races were run in Buenos Aires, and these proved crucial in Gonzalez's progression in racing. Mercedes-Benz made its return to the sport here, entering three of the W154s which had dominated the 1939 Grand Prix season, one of them for Fangio. In his supercharged Ferrari, Gonzalez flayed them in both races, and that registered in Maranello, the home of Ferrari. I bet it did. After that, I had a good relationship with Ferrari. When I arrived in Europe, I went to see the Commendatore and I told him that if he needed me, obviously, I would be very willing to drive for him. Commendatore, folks, is obviously Enzo Ferrari in this case. There were to be four Ferrari drivers, Ascari, Villoresi, Taruffi and Dorio Serafini. But when Serafini broke his leg in the Mille Miglia, Ferrari asked me to drive for him at Reims. Gonzalez adapted readily to the 4.5-litre Ferrari 375, qualifying 6, and then in the race handing over to Ascari, whose own car had retired. I came in to refuel and the team director said, "Unfortunately, Ascari has to get in the car." And there wasn't much I could do. I didn't have a contract then. They were trying me out, that's all. Ascari eventually finished second and got 6 points, but they were split between us. It was the same for Fangio, who won for Alfa. He took over after Luigi Fagioli's car developed problems. After Reims, Fermi called. He said, "I want you to race Serafini's car all season. If you want to, you can." Then we made up a contract. To be honest, I didn't even know what it said. So I asked the Commendatore, "Are all your drivers insured?" He said they were. So I said, "Okay, that's good, I'll sign. I got a wage." I think Ascari, Villoresi and Taruffini got 50% of the starting money, which was about $2,500. He also gave me some money for expenses. Next on the agenda was the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, a track at which Gonzalez had never raced before, and he rather stunned everybody by taking pole position by a clear second. That's 1 second in time. That's a lot in this form of motorsport. Ah yes, Silverstone, 51. There were four cars on the front row, myself, Fangio, Farini and Ascari. At the drivers' meeting, they said the first who jumped the start, would get a 1 minute penalty. We were all so frightened that none of us moved, and all three cars on the second row went straight past us. At the first corner, I was back in fifth, but I passed Felice Bonito for the lead on the second lap, and Fangio, who'd even lost more places, got into second place. Then it was a fight with him all the way. As he had at Reims, Ascari retired, but this time there was no question of Gonzalez being asked to hand over to him. I was waiting for Fangio to stop for fuel before me. I had a lot of fuel on board, but Alfa had far higher consumption. Ferrari was signalling every lap for me to come in, but I knew I was okay because I still had the reserve tank to use. Of course, there was no way I could tell them. No radio in those days. Ah, what a race. It was my first win, and also the first for Engelbert Tyson Formula One. He's no relation to Engelbert Humperdinck. I'll just point that out. Engelbert Tyres, no relation at all. Two of the Ferraris were built on Pirelli because of the money. The other two were on Engelbert, also because of the money. But we didn't get any of that. It all went to Enzo. Photographs of Gonzalez that day, always apparently on opposite Locke. Chime with me like those of Fangio, he said, in his Maserati 250F at Rouen in 1957. I told him that I'd been at Silverstone aged 5 and he grinned. No, well, that day I signed an autograph for Jackie Stewart. I think he was 11 or 12, and he says that he's always kept it. It rained for 16 or 17 of the 24 hours, and I drove something like 4,000 on my own. At the end of 1951, Alfa Romeo withdrew from Grand Prix racing, and Fangio decided to go to Maserati, persuading Gonzalez to join him. I didn't want to leave Ferrari, and Ferrari wanted me to stay. But Maserati paid better. A little bit more money was important in those days. In terms of results, the next two seasons were desultory ones if you were not a Ferrari driver. But Gonzalez supplemented his income by also driving the BRM V16 in selected races. Moss, I said, reckoned it was the worst car he had ever driven. No. Actually, I think Stirling was very afraid of that car. BRM gave Fangio and myself £1,000 and we divided it between us to do the testing for 1 year. Yes, there were many problems. When you started to brake, if you wanted to turn in, you just went in another direction. At Albi in 53, I finished second, but the big problem was always with tyres. Ferrari stretched his engine from 4.5 to 5 litres, thinking he would fight the BRMs, but we passed them on the straight as if they were standing still. We had to be very careful, though, because the tyres kept coming off the rims. That happened to me on one lap, and a huge piece of tread hit the side of my helmet. In 1954, Gonzalez returned to Ferrari and had a superb season, again winning at Silverstone, the GP and Daily Express trophy, and taking a magnificent victory with Maurice Tringonnet in the Le Mans 24 Hours. That was the most spectacular race, very difficult. It rained a lot and I did most of the driving. It was a fight with the Jaguars, particularly the Rolt Hamilton car. The Jaguar was better than the Ferrari in the wet, but we had more power. 2 hours from the end there was a storm, but we were still ahead. Then, with half an hour left, we had our last stop for a bit of fuel and the engine wouldn't restart because the ignition was soaked. Finally, after more than 7 minutes, they got it going and were able to win by less than 4 kilometres. A few weeks later, though, came the tragedy would ultimately to bring about the end of Gonzalez's career in Europe. In practice for the German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, his close friend Onofre Marimont crashed his Maserati and was killed instantly. Marimont went on and went off, hit the trees, that was it. It was a nightmare. Today, if a driver dies, it's a big tragedy, but in those days, you had about a 50% chance of surviving. At circuits like the Nürburgring, there was no safety. He went off, hit the trees, that's it. His father and mother were there, and my parents too. It was just horrible. Gonzalez, demented with grief, drove in the race and even led for a while, but eventually handed his car over to Mike Hawthorn. I started to have a lot of problems with my wife because of Marimont's accident. My parents didn't want me to race either. They all put a lot of pressure on me to stop. Gonzalez continued to race in South America, winning 2 titles in a Ferrari, but it was left to Fangio to fly the flag abroad. His friendship with Fangio was a lifelong one, and Gonzalez reveres his memory. There were some strong drivers, Ascari, Moss, Farina, sometimes, but I think one in those days was like Schumacher today. He always had the ace up his sleeve. And that was a story all about the original Speedy Gonzalez, Froilán Gonzalez, who died just a couple of years ago, well into his 80s. And it was written by Nigel Roebuck, and it came from the Motorsport magazine. COVID's over, you'd move over there just for the music, hey? And now we go to motoringresearch.com, and this is by John Redfern, written in April of this year. What's in a name? Choosing a name for a new car is a difficult task, especially when it needs to appeal to a global audience. While some might be easy to understand, others can be a little bit more challenging. We've taken a look at a host of modern cars and manufacturers with names that might cause problems in pronunciation. Yes, folks, I'm working without a net here this afternoon. Many languages and dialects have specific pronunciations, but the guidance here should allow for close approximation. Approximation, even. I can't even get that right. I've got no hope. Anyway, hang on, it's going to be a bumpy ride. After this, you should be able to call out these vehicles with confidence. Here we go. The 2011 Pagani Huayra. Named after the founder, Horacio Pagani, this Italian supercar manufacturer has been building exclusive performance cars since 1992. Engines supplied by Mercedes, AMG, and the carbon fibre construction are combined with dramatic interior and exterior styling. The Huayra is the latest model from the company and is named after Huayra Tata, a god worshipped by the indigenous people of South America. The Quechua language means the name is pronounced Huayra with a silent H. The first car on the list was actually an American car, but, you know, come on, we've got to be serious about this. The 2019 Koenigsegg Jesko. European supercar companies have a habit of being named after their founders, with Sweden's Koenigsegg being no exception. The firm was launched in 1994 by Christian von Koenigsegg, with the sole purpose of creating the most extreme sports cars on the planet. His dedication has seen a host of high-performance produced vehicles featuring gigantic horsepower and incredible top speeds. The twin-turbo Jesko generates an astonishing 1,600 horsepower and a potential top speed of 300 miles an hour. A multiple of vowels makes for an intimidating name, but the name is pronounced Koenigsegg, with his 29 model read as Jesko. How about this one? The 2017 Dongevoort D8 GTO RS. Originally building modified Lotus kit cars, the Ditch oh, it had to happen, didn't it? The Dutch company Dongevoort has evolved into making Audi-powered machines and setting the Nürburgring lap record. The latest D8 GTO RS wears a carbon fibre body and uses a 386 horsepower, 2.5-litre turbocharged 5-cylinder engine. Tipping the scales at less than 1,600 pounds, the D8 GTO RS has the ability to accelerate from 0 to 124 miles an hour in under 8 seconds. Saying the name is slightly quicker, with it's pronounced simply as Dongevoort, a favourite of mine. I've seen them driving around the streets of Sydney. I wouldn't mind one, but anyway, it's never going to happen. A 2013 Maserati Ghibli. The different versions of the Maserati Ghibli have been made since 1967. See, I've been in love with it a long time. But the latest generation, a four-door sedan, launched in 2013. More than 100,000 examples of the big new Ghibli have been made to date, offered with a range of gasoline and diesel engines. The name comes from Libyan Arabic, and it's a word for the wind that blows across the Mediterranean. Pronunciation as simple as saying Ghibli. passion with a capital P. Back to the story, folks. The 2014 Lamborghini Huracan wins are a favoured choice for naming inspiration when it comes to supercars. Probably because it puts the wind up you when you drive them too quick or they get out of control. But anyway, Lamborghini takes a slightly different approach. Whilst Huracan may be the Spanish word for hurricane, the car is actually named after the famed Spanish fighting bull. The V10 engine producing over 630 horsepower in the latest EVO model, the Huracan, has proven to be a formidable mid-engine supercar. All-wheel drive is standard, although a special rear-wheel drive version is also available. The Spanish origin of the Huracan name means that the H is silent, pronounced it as Huracan, to impress future car buyers and coffee buddies. See, I pronounced it Huracan on purpose, incorrectly, at the start, and made up for it at the end. You believe that? You believe anything. Sticking with Lamborghini, how about the 2001 Murcielago? The earlier V12 Murcielago supercar conformed to the Lamborghini's naming convention. Murcielago was the legendary fighting bull said to have withstood multiple sword strikes. However, the word is itself actually just the Spanish word for bat. Correct pronunciation is dependent on regional Spanish dialect, with Murcielago the most commonly accepted way to say it. Experts state that emphasis should be placed on the middle syllable and not the last. My sympathies actually rest with the bull on that one. The 2015 Alfa Romeo Giulia Quadrifoglio. Introduced in 2016, the Alfa Romeo Giulia sedan has helped put the Italian brand back on the map. With a 500 horsepower turbocharged V6 engine, the range-chopping Giulia Quadrifoglio makes a bold statement. Giulia is the Italian version of Julia, and the name is pronounced as the same as the English spelling would be. Quadrifoglio is how to say Quadrifoglio. Being Italian, the word for a four-leaf clover. Alfa Romeo reserves this badge for performance models, having first been used in the 1923 cars entered into the Targa Florio race. Here's my favourite, the 911 Porsche. That's quite easy, actually, anyway. But in continuous production since 1963, the 911 is one of the most iconic sports cars ever made. Porsche's rear engine legend has undergone serious mechanical transformation, but the name has remained the same. Pronounced in German as Neun Alpha, this means English-speaking owners should say 911 instead of 911. German speakers would also ensure they read the company name as Porsche, as opposed to the single syllable Porsche version. How about Jaguar? Well, whether you say Jaguar or Jaguar, it's likely to depend on which side of the Atlantic you live on. Yet the big cat inspired the company name, and it's actually South American and taken from the indigenous Tupi language. Linguists believe that both pronunciations are correct, but that the North Americans say Jaguar actually is a closer approximation of the Tupi word. Well, there you are, hey? I got that right. That's something. Here's another one, quite similar. Nissan. Along with specific model names, we've also examined some of the car companies with different pronunciation. British English and American English speakers frequently disagree over Nissan, with those in the United Kingdom preferring to say the more literal Nissan. However, the Americanized accent of Nissan is noted to be closer to the correct Japanese pronunciation. How about that? 2 out of 2 for our friends in North America. This is a favourite of mine, Hyundai. As one of the largest auto manufacturers across the globe, Hyundai has seen dramatic growth in the past 2 decades. The company's recent Super Bowl advert for the new Sonata poked fun at the Boston accent, But just what is the right way to say Hyundai? In North America, Hyundai has been the pronunciation used in advertising for many years. This is said to be closer, if not completely accurate, an approximation of the traditional Korean pronunciation. However, British English speakers are likely to use three syllables, saying the name as Hyundai. The Koreans told me you pronounce it like Sunday, but with an H, so I'll stick with what they've told me. Tesla. The Tesla brand never seems to be far away from some degree of controversy, with even the way to pronounce the name sparking debate. With the name taken from the Croatian-born Serbian-American inventor Nikolai Tesla, purists argue that the unvoiced S is the correct way to say it. This should mean pronouncing the company name as Tesla, whereas Tesla's CEO, Elon Musk, prefers to say Tesla instead. However, company representatives state they are happy with either version. I suppose as long as it makes money on the stock market, they're going to be happy anyway. I think we might have some more of that guitar music of Spain and Latin America at some other time. However, Dexter will continue to take us out. Thanks for your company today. I hope you enjoyed learning how to pronounce unpronounceable names. We haven't finished that. We'll have a bit more for you in another episode. And a great story from motor racing history, which we'll bring you another episode of in a week or so. This one concerns the very fast Speedy Gonzales, Friolan Gonzales, that very fast Argentinian. So we hit the Tabasco Road with him at 30 laps, and I hope you had a good time hearing all about his escapades in a very dangerous sport as it was in those days. Well, it is today, but still particularly dangerous. Until next week, bye for now.